Well, we come now to our 31st study period here at the Puyallup Camp, 1982. This is the 10:30 study period on Thursday morning, September 2, 1982. We'll now continue with the consideration of the events that take place at the end of the 1,000 years. We've already listed a couple of them, namely the Christ descent, the wicked arise, Christ then flattens out the Mount of Olives, and the Holy City descends. I'd like now to read confirmation of this in the book Great Controversy. Page 662 across to page 663. Christ descends upon the Mount of Olives, whence, after his resurrection, he ascended, and where angels repeated the promise of his return. Says the prophet, the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee, and his feet shall stand on that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem in the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof, and there shall be a very great valley. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth, and that day shall there be one Lord, and his name one. Zechariah 14 verse 5 and 4 verse and 9. As the New Jerusalem in its dazzling splendor comes down out of heaven, it rests upon the place purified and made ready to receive it, and Christ with his people and the angels enters the holy city. So that paragraph confirms the sequence which John had placed on the board. And as the wicked find themselves outside that city, they must then know, of course, that they have been eternally lost at that point. The scene now is that on this earth we have first of all, we just draw it here, we have first of all the holy city which is square. It's resting now upon a purified, sanctified plain where once the Mount of Olives stood. Inside will be Christ and his Father and the angels and the saved inside the city. Outside, of course, will be the millions of this earth who are lost, together with Satan and his evil angels. And there does seem to be some indication that at this time Satan has lost his power to remain invisible. It seems, I can't say for certain though, that the wicked are able to see their commander in person at this point of time. Now, as I said, I think yesterday, Satan never ever gives up. Even when it's clear after 7,000 years of miserable failure that God has won the struggle and the holy city has come down and it's invisible, Satan still will not give up. He acts as if he's got everything going his way. Let's turn to Revelation 20 and read this. <clears throat> 20th chapter of the book of Revelation. We start with verse 8. And shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Now it states in verse 9, they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about. Now with what purpose in view? Obviously the purpose of conquest. This is a siege. They will besiege the city of God. Now, I'll read now on page 663 in the book Great Controversy. Comments on this activity on Satan's part. Now Satan prepares for a last mighty struggle for the supremacy. While deprived of his power and cut off from his work of deception, the prince of evil was miserable and dejected. But as the wicked dead are raised and he sees the vast multitudes upon his side, his hopes revive and he determines not to yield the great controversy. He will marshal all the armies of the lost under his banner and through them endeavor to execute his plan. The wicked are Satan's captives. In rejecting Christ, they have accepted the rule of the rebel leader. They are ready to receive his suggestions and to do his bidding. Yet, true to his early cunning, he does not acknowledge himself to be Satan. He claims to be the prince who is the rightful owner of the world and whose inheritance has been unlawfully wrested from him. He represents himself to his deluded subjects as a redeemer, assuring them that his power has brought them forth from their graves, and he is about to rescue them from the most cruel tyranny. The presence of Christ having been removed, Satan works wonders to support his claims. He makes the weak strong and inspires all with his own spirit and energy. He proposes to lead them against the camp of the saints and to take possession of the city of God. With fiendish exultation, he points to the unnumbered millions who have been raised from the dead and declares that as their leader, he is well able to overthrow the city and regain his throne and his kingdom. Now, a deceiver to the end, isn't he? Right? He does not acknowledge himself to be Satan. If he did, what then? Would they follow him? Hardly. Instead, they would reject him and begin to fight amongst themselves and thus ruin any possibility of gaining control of the city and of the redeemed. Now, he's a perfect con man, of course, because he represents himself as the one who has been unlawfully dispossessed of his rightful kingdom. He said, that city is mine, that kingdom is mine, and the being who rules in there has robbed me of my kingdom and I want it back, and if only you folk will help me to get it back, then you and I will share in the glory of that wonderful kingdom. Now, coming across to page 664, Sister White now begins to give a summary of the kind of men that will be brought together under Satan's rulership at this point of time. First of all, there'll be the greatest and most wonderful men of all, the antediluvians. Now, we understand, well, we know first of all that these men lived for close to 1,000 years, many of them. They were at least 12 feet tall. Now, imagine a man walking in this room today 12 feet tall. This ceiling is about 7 foot 6, I would say, at the outside. So imagine a man who went 4 foot 6 to 5 feet above that ceiling. He'd have a job getting in here, wouldn't he? Imagine that size of a man riding in aircraft, modern aircraft. He certainly couldn't fit in Alan's and my aircraft. There wouldn't be any hope in the world of his doing that. I suppose if they put special seats in the 747, he might be able to get in very stooped and sideways to the doorway. And he certainly wouldn't fit in the modern automobile. He just would be completely out of place in our present world. But those men were not only huge physically compared to our present diminished stature, but they also possessed gigantic intellects. I mentioned during the week that Sister White has told us that back in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve had 20 times the electrical energy which we have in our bodies at the present time. And that means 20 times the brain power. Maybe more than that. Now, of course, the sinners this side of the Garden of Eden already have lost some of that brain power, but they were still possessed maybe 15 or 16 times, or at least 10 times the intellectual strength which we have at the present moment. And I just wonder what fantastic inventions they must have possessed back before the flood, although they would not have the incentive to invent as much as we have today, because they would have within themselves the abilities that far surpass our own. And then, of course, down to the ages, there are those military geniuses such as the Caesars, certain of the Caesars, Napoleon, Charlemagne, and so forth. And then, of course, there are the tremendous inventors, men who understand the depths of physics and science and who know how to put together weapons of indescribable destructive power. Now, what Satan finds, of course, is that in each of these men there burns the passion to rule and to conquer. I often ask myself the question, what in the world drives a man to spend millions of dollars to become United States President for 3 or 4 years or 6 or 8 years if he gets a second term? I think he's just plain crazy, don't you? But they're driven to it, aren't they? There's a a consuming passion to occupy this position and rule over the world, to be the president of the most powerful nation upon the face of the earth. And so Sister White says here, toward the end of that first paragraph on page 664, there were kings and generals who conquered nations, valiant men who never lost a battle, proud, ambitious warriors whose approach made kingdoms tremble. In death, these experienced no change. As they come up from the grave, they resume the current of their thoughts just where it ceased. They are actuated by the same desire to conquer that ruled them when they fell. Satan consults with his angels, and then with these kings and conquerors and mighty men. They look upon the strength and numbers on their side and declare that the army within the city is small in comparison with theirs, and that it can be overcome. They lay their plans to take possession of the riches and glory of the New Jerusalem. All immediately begin to prepare for battle. Skillful artisans construct implements of war. Military leaders, famed for their success, marshal the throngs of warlike men into companies and divisions. I've never known Satan to do a job only by half measures. Have you? When he goes to war, what does he use? The best available, and nothing less than the best available. So then, do you suppose that these skillful artisans busy themselves making crossbows and arrows? Hardly. Of course, they recognize that inside the city they see no evidence of military weapons there, none whatsoever. But of course, the walls are very high and the gates are very solid, and they will need some means to break down those walls. So I rather expect that they would use the most formidable weapons known to man, which would include atomic and cosmic rocketry and that kind of thing. Now bear in mind that God leaves Satan, God sets no deadline on this program. Satan can take as long as he likes to make these preparations. I've often asked myself the question, how does he feed this vast multitude? Never in all human history has the world been burdened by so much humanity as at this point of time, because this is the collective numbers of all the people who have ever lived upon this earth from the very beginning of time, not just one generation of them, or perhaps three generations of them. At any given time we have three generations living, or maybe sometimes four. When we get a four generation family photograph, I think it's quite remarkable, don't we? I belong to four living generations: my mother, myself, my children, and my grandchildren. But not so many people can claim that, and very, very few can claim five generations, right? True. It will have all been broken in, but at least it'll have 1,000 years of rest, so there will be possibly a very high level of productivity after 1,000 years of rest from growing food and so forth. So we'll be interested when we get to heaven. We're not told at the present time, but we'll be interested to learn there how these folk will be fed and housed during this period of time. What will the weather conditions be like during that period? Pardon? Where the holy city will be, which of course will be in the Mount of Olives in the midst of Palestine, which does have a reasonable climate the whole year round. So there'll be no snow and ice unless we have something very abnormal at that point of time. So we don't know the answers to these questions, so please don't ask them of me afterwards, will you? The one thing is very clear: God sets no deadline, and they can take 100 years if they want to prepare for this tremendous battle. Mind you, I don't expect them to take that long, because Satan will recognize that he must work reasonably quickly to capitalize upon the enthusiasm before it dies away and a reaction sets in. The next paragraph says, "At last." Now, what do those two words indicate? At last, the order to advance is given. What do the two words "at last" indicate? Quite a long period of time. We don't know how long, as I said before. And the countless host moves on, an army such as was never summoned by earthly conquerors, such as the combined forces of all ages since war began on earth could never equal. Now you stop and think about this. How old will the earth be by the time Jesus Christ returns and human reproduction ceases? 6,000 years. Now what would you say is the average generation? About 20 years? Most folk have their first baby about 20, don't they? Right. So every 20 years we find a new crop of babies coming into the world. So let's say 25 years, because back there, of course, it wasn't quite so frequent. They had children a little later than we seem to have at the present time. And how many times did 25 go into 6,000? 240. Right. Just divide by 100, multiply by 4. 240 generations. That's all. That seems surprisingly small, doesn't it? 240 generations. But that's what it is. If you say every 25 years a new crop of babies are being born, then in 6,000 years we have 240 such new crops of babies being born. Now what shall we say is an average? At the present time, the earth population numbers over 2 billion, doesn't it? It's over 2 billion. But the present generation, of course, is exceptional. It's not by any means what you call an average. If you go back, for instance, 100 years ago, 150 years or 200 years ago, here in North America, the United States of America, without Canada and Mexico, but just the United States of America, there is a very, very small population compared to what there presently is. Here you have about 250 million people at present in the United States of America, right? About 250 million. I remember it passed the 200 million mark in this country about 10 years ago, and now we're chasing about 250 more or less. But if you go back 150 years ago, you might find, or 200 years ago, you might find 30 or 40,000 people in this country. That's all. So there's been a population explosion over the past two centuries. Now, the Bible says that back in the days of the flood, when men began to multiply upon the earth, then the flood came. And again it says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be. So I'm really at a loss to know what we could call an average population per generation during those 250 generations. Certainly, of course, the first generation numbered two people, Adam and Eve, just two people. And it took a few years, of course, to multiply to the place where there's a few million of them. But I wonder if we could say somewhere about an average of about 100 million people per generation. What do you think? About 100 million. That's a figure anyway. So 100 million would give us 240 million people. That seems too small. That's much too small because at the present time we have at least 2 billion. Now how much are 2 billion in American figures? 2,000 million? Is that 2 billion? Pardon? 2,000 million. Alright, well then a figure of 100 million, wait a minute, 240 times, well that's right, that would give us 240 billion. Yeah. Okay, so if we had 100 million for each generation on the average, then we'd have 240 billion people upon the earth around the city in the last great showdown. Now can you begin to imagine what an enormous crowd of people that would be? Just imagine you're in the city, and you look out, and here is this sea of people moving toward that city. And you look around you at the people with you in the city, and there might be a few, maybe 50 million, we don't know what there'll be, but there'll be quite a crowd, of course. But Satan says that the number in the city is very small compared to the vast numbers at his command. Now, what an impressive sight it'll be to see 250 billion people advancing across the landscape toward the city, moving in regular order, an army under perfect control by its generals. Impressive? Certainly will be impressive. Now as they move on, there comes a point of time when they're halted against their will. I now read on, page 664. At last the order to advance is given, and the countless host moves on. An army such was never summoned by earthly conquerors, such as the combined forces of all ages since war began on earth could never equal. Satan, the mightiest of warriors, leads the van, and his angels unite their forces for this final struggle. Kings and warriors are in his train, and the multitude follow in vast companies, each under its appointed leader. With military precision, the serried ranks advance over the earth broken and an even service to the city of God. By command of Jesus, the gates of the New Jerusalem are closed, and the armies of Satan surround the city and make ready for the onset. What a moment of tension that'll be. Now Christ again appears to the view of his enemies. Far above the city, upon a foundation of burnished gold, is a throne high and lifted up. Upon this throne sits the Son of God, and around him are the subjects of his kingdom. The power and majesty of Christ no language can describe, no pen portray. The glory of the eternal Father is enshrouding his Son. The brightness of his presence fills the city of God and flows out beyond the gates, flooding the whole earth with its radiance. And by the way, notice that the wicked are not slain by that brightness, are they? The wicked are never slain by the physical brightness of Jesus Christ. Never. And the idea that when Christ comes a second time, and as the scripture says, they're slain by the brightness of his coming, that's a false. It's a false idea to believe that the actual light of Christ's presence consumes the wicked. The brightness of his coming, of course, is the message which drives them into total resistance to God's will, and thus deprives them of God's presence. And that separation from God, not the blazing glory of God, is what brings about their destruction. Now, the next paragraph is one I read the other day, which outlines the positions occupied by God's people around Christ at this time. Nearest to him will be those who perfected characters amidst falsehood and infidelity. Then there are those, nearest to those who have plucked his branch from the burning, who had been very zealous in the cause of Satan. Then those who have been faithful during periods of falsehood and infidelity. Then those who honor the law of God when the Christian world made it void, the martyrs, and last of all, the great multitude. Now, these all, in the presence of the onlooking wicked, ascribe unlimited praise and gratitude to Jesus Christ for their salvation. And that testimony, of course, must be an extremely impressive one on the minds of those wicked people. And by this time, no doubt the foundations of doubt are being laid in their minds, that after all Satan has told them the truth when he told them that he had been wrongfully dispossessed of this kingdom, which was now owned by a usurper or an impostor. By this time the wicked must begin to ask themselves now, was that the truth in reality? We move on now to the drama as it begins to unfold. The next event, of course, is the crowning of Jesus Christ as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Page 666, a very appropriate page really for what we're now about to read. In the presence of the assembled inhabitants of earth and heaven, the final coronation of the Son of God takes place. And now, invested with supreme majesty and power, the King of Kings pronounces a sentence upon the rebels against his government and executes justice upon those who have transgressed his law and oppressed his people. It says the prophet of God, and you can read this in Revelation 20, verse 11 and 12. I'll read it from the Bible. And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. Now, in that very brief statement in the last paragraph, it simply said that Christ pronounced a sentence upon the rebels against his government and executes justice upon those who have transgressed his law and oppressed his people. Now, this judgment scene now is not without an actual trial. In other words, evidence is advanced and presented. Let's now read this next paragraph. As soon as the books of record are opened and the eye of Jesus looks upon the wicked, they are conscious of every sin which they have ever committed. And that's going to turn their eyes, of course, off their leader. It's going to turn their eyes off Jesus Christ, and it'll turn their eyes upon whom? Themselves. And when they see every sin which they've ever committed, when they see just where their feet diverge from the path of purity and holiness, just how far rebellion, pride and rebellion have carried them in violation of the law of God, the seductive temptation in which they encouraged by indulgence in sin, the blessings perverted, the messengers of God despised, the warnings rejected, the waves of mercy beaten back by the stubborn, unrepentant heart, all appear as if written in letters of fire. Now, will this bring upon them an unwilling conviction of what they really are? Right, it will. Now, of course, could God be more fair and just than to treat them in this way? He couldn't, could he? No possibility. And now, turning away from their own revelation, or not their own, but the revelation of their own sin, God now, in living color and full sound, portrays, as if on a giant screen above the city, the major events in the great controversy. I'll read now in the next paragraph. Above the throne is revealed the cross, and like a panoramic view appear the scenes of Adam's temptation and fall and the successive steps in the great plan of redemption. Have you ever imagined what it would be like to have the power to enter a time machine with a nice efficient movie camera or video camera with full sound capacities, widescreen and all the rest of it, and press the buttons and land back in the midst of the golden calf scene or the flood scene or the crucifixion of Christ and bring back from those bygone days actual pictures of those actual events? Ever imagine yourself wanting to do that? I have. It would be a film of tremendous value if we could. Yet I suppose the men would rather have their dramatized, imagined versions than the actual real thing, because reality is often much more dull than fiction, isn't it? Now, God has all those records. It won't be on video or film, because he has much more sophisticated methods of keeping records than that. And when that time comes, God will demonstrate his capacity to rerun those scenes exactly as they were. Nothing added and nothing taken away. First of all, the scenes of Adam's temptation and fall. Moving on, the Savior's lowly birth, his early life of simplicity and obedience, his baptism in Jordan, the fast and temptation in the wilderness, his public ministry unfolding to men heaven's most precious blessings, the days crowded with deeds of love and mercy, the nights of prayer and watching in the solitude of the mountains, the plottings of envy, hate and malice which repaid his benefits, the awful mysterious agony in Gethsemane beneath the crushing weight of the sins of the whole world, his betrayal into the hands of the murderous mob, the fearful events of that night of horrors, the unresisting prisoner forsaken by his best-loved disciples, rudely hurried through the streets of Jerusalem, the Son of God exultingly displayed before Annas, arraigned in the high priest's palace, in the judgment hall of Pilate, before the cowardly and cruel Herod, mocked, insulted, tortured, and condemned to die, all are vividly portrayed. Now, I ask myself the question, if these are going to be portrayed at normal speed, that is, we'll see it at the same speed at which it happened, how long is this portrayal going to take? Years. If it's done completely, I mean, how long was Christ's ministry upon this earth? 3.5 years. Then there was Adam's temptation and fall and the major events in the great controversy. It may be, of course, that God will give the wicked the ability to see this at high speed and take it in at high speed, so the whole thing is covered at a much shorter period of time. Ever had a dream where you dream that you're falling from a great height, and you seem to be falling for a long, long time, And then you suddenly wake up as you crash upon the floor. Ever had that sort of dream? I certainly have. It's amazing how much passes through your mind as if in slow motion, all in that probably a half a second between the time when you roll off the bed and hit the floor. It's amazing. So it just could be, I say could be, that God will speed things up in this particular way. But when I read all that to be portrayed, it says, for instance, the days crowded with deeds of love and mercy, all vividly portrayed, days of it. So the wicked are in for quite an exhibition. Now it will be necessary for God to give a very complete portrayal of these major events in the plan of salvation. Any abridged version will not serve the purpose designed. Because when these wicked go down to their graves, they must go down with every doubt about the character of God and the ways of God totally and eternally removed from their minds. God demands this, not for himself. God doesn't need this for himself. God needs this, of course, for his own children, because God is determined that never again is sin going to raise its ugly head throughout the universe or throughout eternity. Now move on, page 667. And now before the swaying multitude are revealed the final scenes, the patient sufferer treading the path to Calvary, the Prince of Heaven hanging upon the cross, the haughty priests and the jeering rabble deriding his expiring agony, the supernatural darkness, the heaving earth, the rent rocks, the open graves, marking the moment when the world's Redeemer yielded up his life. The awful spectacle appears just as it was. Satan, his angels, and his subjects have no power to turn from the picture of their own work. Each actor recalls the part which he performed. Herod, who slew the innocent children of Bethlehem, that he might destroy the king of Israel, the base Herodias, upon whose guilty soul rests the blood of John the Baptist, the weak time-serving Pilate, the mocking soldiers, the priests and rulers, and the maddened throng who cry, "His blood be on us and on our children," all behold the enormity of their guilt. They vainly seek to hide from the divine majesty of his countenance, outshining the glory of the Son, while the redeemed cast their crowns at the Saviour's feet, exclaiming, "He died for us." Now, he died for me, I should read it more accurately. Now, I just digress to a point which we might not have caught on to as we went through this reading. In the blotting out of sins, which takes place, of course, before the 1,000 years, the sins of the righteous will be blotted out. And many folk have gotten the idea this means the blotting out of the records of sin. But it can't mean that, for a number of good reasons, all of which I will not explore today as our time is too limited. But let me ask you this question. If the blotting out of sins is the blotting out of the record of sins, then how could these records be portrayed at the end of the 1,000 years? Now think, for instance, because we're thinking in terms of the blotting and the sins of the righteous, but first of all, we have certain characters mentioned by name in these paragraphs which are going to be in heaven and whose sins will have been blotted out by the time we come to the close of probation. Let me ask you now, for instance, will Adam be saved in the kingdom? Definitely. How do we know? Great controversy says so, right? We can read it at the second coming of Christ, when the first Adam is greeted by the second Adam and given back his lost inheritance. Will the disciples of Christ, apart from Judas of course, the 11 disciples, will they be in the kingdom? Yeah. Certainly. And who takes the place of Judas? Paul does. Right, Paul is the 12th apostle, not Matthias, the man who is voted in by other men to be the 12th apostle. God doesn't accept that. Paul is the 12th apostle, and those 12 apostles have their names engraven in the foundations of the city of God. So by that statement from Revelation 21 and 2, we know that they're going to be in the kingdom. Now, in the statement it says, above the throne is revealed the cross, and like a panoramic view appear the scenes of Adam's temptation and fall. So Adam's sin in taking that fruit from his wife's hand and turning away from God will be portrayed upon that screen, if we can use that word screen, in living color so everyone can see it. Now, would that be possible if the blotting out of Adam's sin was the blotting out of the record of that sin? It wouldn't, would it? Now, a little further on we read, the unresisting prisoner forsaken by his best-loved disciples, all this is vividly portrayed. Now, obviously, of course, again, there's going to be portrayed up there upon, before their wondering eyes, the sin of Peter when he said, with cursing and swearing, I know him not, I know him not, I know him not, and then the cock crew, the cock crowed. Now, if that awful sin, now in all history, there are a few sins worse, if any, than Peter's denial of Jesus Christ. Isn't that right? There are a few things worse than that. And certainly Peter was ashamed of what he'd done that night and carried that sense of shame for the rest of his days. And Peter's sins will most certainly have been blotted out by the time the work of atonement in the most holy place is completed. And once again I say, if the blotting out of sins is the blotting out of the record of sin, then how could that be portrayed at the end of the 1,000 years? It couldn't, could it? Now, the blotting out of sin is the blotting out of sin, not the blotting out of the record of it. The record, we're told, is going to remain to all eternity, and we are informed that the Bible is going to be in heaven. I read it to you today already in the statement that talks about the judgment, because it says the redeemed, let me get the exact words again, toward the end of the last chapter, page 661, in union with Christ, they judge the wicked, comparing their acts with the statute book, the Bible, and deciding every case according to the deeds done in the body. So during the 1,000 years, what will be the reference book used by the redeemed in their judging of the wicked? The Bible. Very good. Will it be an abridged version? Will it have deleted from it David's sin with Bathsheba? Will it have deleted from it the sin of Adam in the Garden of Eden, or of the disciples on the way to in the Garden of Gethsemane? Will all those things be omitted? Of course they will not. In Selected Messages, Volume 1, page 3-2, Sister White records the fact that the angel told her to write what she was being shown by the heavenly agencies in books, and these books would be immortalized. So the spirit of prophecy will also be where? In heaven. These books will be immortalized, which of course gives us some idea of the status that they enjoy in God's sight, as they certainly would, of course, being his word. So these books then, which contain detailed descriptions of the sin of David, of Peter, of James and John, and of other great worthies down through history, will all be immortalized. And if immortalized, then the records of those men's sin will stand to all eternity as a witness that with God's law is bound up the happiness of all the beings he has created. And this comes, of course, as quite a shock for some people. But what we have to realize is this, of course, that the records as they're written up in the books of heaven are not records of sin, but they're records of victory over sin. Now you pause a moment right now and you think back on your own past experience with God. And what are the most precious memories, or among the most precious memories that you have of your past life? Is it not those glorious victories, those wonderful deliverances gained from sin's controlling power, and when you have been delivered from that bondage into the freedom of Christ's righteousness? Do you want to forget those things? Certainly we don't want to forget those things. I've had experiences which I would love to tell you about, but of course there's something we don't tell in this life, because if we did, they would give the enemies of the message an opportunity to bring in all kinds of trouble and difficulty amongst God's people. And we need to have wisdom and discretion about recalling the sins of our past lives here and telling the victories gained over those sins. But in the new earth, of course, when the danger is removed, we shall gladly tell what we were and what through the grace of Christ we became. And we'll be glad to know those records are there, and be glad to let anyone who wishes to read them in their fullest details. Now on page 481, I'll read a statement in regard to the Book of Remembrance. A Book of Remembrance is written before God, in which are recorded the good deeds of them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name, Malachi 3 and verse 16. This is Great Controversy, page 481. Their words of faith, their acts of love are registered in heaven. Nehemiah refers to this when he says, "Remember me, O my God, and wipe not out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God." Nehemiah 13 verse 14. Now pay close attention to this next sentence, because as it is read, you will get a different impression from the explanation of it, which is given by the Spirit of Prophecy. It says, "In the book of God's remembrance, every deed of righteousness is immortalized." Now, what are deeds of righteousness? Here comes the explanation. You would, if I asked you to define deeds of righteousness, you'd think only of good deeds, wouldn't you? Kind deeds, loving deeds, merciful deeds, all the positive things we've done in our lives. But now here's a list of what is meant by that statement. There, every temptation resisted. That is a deed of righteousness. Every temptation resisted. Next, every evil overcome. Next, every word of tender pity expressed is faithfully chronicled. Now how can you make a faithful chronicle of an evil overcome if you don't record the evil which is overcome? Right? That's obvious, isn't it? So, as victories over sin, every evil of your life will be eternally maintained in the books of record up in heaven. They'll be immortalized, and inasmuch as those who are going to be saved will have gained the victory over every single evil, then their record will be only a story of victories gained. Now, for instance, when we have a national hero in this country, America, or down in our country, Australia, a war hero, for instance, who went to fight in France or North Africa or someplace like that during the Second World War, and that man was given the Congressional Medal of Honor, for instance, for his valor and bravery, then in order for folk to appreciate the bravery which that man exhibited, the conditions under which he fought, the handicaps he had to suffer, the nature of the enemy's attack, the bodies all around him, all those things must be told in vivid detail if we're to really appreciate the heroism which that man exhibited on the field of battle. We can't say, well, he got the Medal of Honor for being very brave. That's not good enough. People say, well, what did he do? How brave was he really? What did he have to face? What did he achieve? And so likewise, if in eternity the victories gained by the righteous are to be truly appreciated, then we have to know the forces against which they have to contend, the evils which control their lives, and the victory gained over those things in their due course. And so the very fact that these records will be revealed or portrayed at the end of the 1,000 years, while the wicked stand around the city, of course, is an evidence that they will not have been blotted out. Now, time is about gone, but perhaps I'll quickly make this point. Another reason why those records must remain is this. In the crowd up in the city will be Peter, for instance. Now, let's imagine that outside, we don't know whether she will have been saved or not, but let's suppose that the maid who questioned him three times will be a lost soul. And she stands outside and says, "Oh, how's this? How is it that man is up there in the city? I heard him cursing the name of Jesus Christ and denying him with cursing and swearing. I never did that. I'm outside and he's inside. How come?" This person will say to God. And God says, "Look, I don't know. I have no record of Peter's sin. What'll that young maiden say?" Well, that's rather hypocritical, won't she? But God will say, "Yes, I know what Peter did. Here's the record of it. See it? Every detail of it. I know it all." And that'll be honesty on God's part. Now God will say, "But this is what Peter did about it. And if you'd done about your sin what Peter did about his sin, you'd be where Peter is at the present moment." And that, by taking this open stand with the records all intact, God is able to escape from all embarrassment and all hypocrisy.